In 2022, state lawmakers have introduced more anti-LGBTQ legislation than in any other year. According to the advocacy group Freedom for All Americans, 39 states had introduced more than 200 such bills by April of this year. That surpasses last year's already record-breaking 151 bills seeking to limit LGBTQ rights. Now, most of these actions target trans youth and include healthcare restrictions, exclusion from sports, and proposing state action against parents for affirming their child's gender. Carolyn Hayes describes her family's experience with an accusation of child abuse for gender-affirming parenting in her new memoir, A Girlhood, Letter to My Transgender Daughter. I talked with Carolyn about raising her daughter and how it led to a visit from Child Protective Services.
Our daughter let us know that she was a girl at a very young age. So she was, you know, assigned male at birth. She's our fourth kid. We were kind of cocky. We like, we've got this down. We understand raising kids, right? But, you know, we did not know what it was to be transgender. We had very little understanding. And so when she started to be, you know, consistent, persistent, and acute in her gender identity really young, we listened and we did the research and we spoke with experts. And then we, you know, we let her at a certain point, you know, go by female pronouns, put a beret in her hair, choose her own clothes, and go by a nickname. Shortly thereafter, we got a knock at the door. And that knock at the door changed our lives. It was from the Department of Children and Families. Someone had made an anonymous call accusing us of child abuse for supporting our daughter. And we quickly found out that in the Deep South, where we were living at the time, with a lot of Republican appointed judges, that if this went poorly and we went up, you know, in front of a judge, that we could actually lose custody. That was terrifying, obviously, for us, as it would be for any family.
Yeah, I wanted to be sure that we were clear that the trauma here was that intervention by the state, not by the experience of parenting a transgender child.
Right. Parenting a transgender child has been fascinating and an amazing journey. There's this quote by Nick Kreiger that I had. He's a transgender man, a writer. He wishes people hadn't told him how hard his life would be, but, you know, how his compassion would grow and his empathy would grow. I mean, it's just this beautiful quote. And that's what we tell our daughter. But it was also definitely true for my husband and for me. You know, we became much broader people. We were seeing the world in a new way. And she really, like, you know, kicked the doors of our heart wide open. So for us, it's been like an interesting journey in terms of faith, but also science and just the incredible architecture of the brain and humanity. Our story is not a tragedy. That's the first line. This is not a tragedy. But of course, yes, having that threat of the government coming in and tearing your family apart, of course, that was tragic.
You wrote a lovely piece about your decision to use a pen name for authoring this book. And there was a sentence that really stood out to me, probably for obvious reasons. You write, "I was both a mother in the thick of it and a writer taking notes. It was a coping mechanism." Can you tell me both about your decision to use the pen name and this experience of being a writer taking notes as a coping mechanism?
And I've published a lot of books under my own name. And the decision to use a pseudonym is to protect my family. You know, that decision to take notes was a number of things. For one thing, I hadn't processed yet what was happening to us. And then also, I really needed my daughter to be old enough to say, it's okay, you have permission, you know, to take this book out, to publish it. And our story just became more urgent as, you know, we've seen more anti-trans policies. But also, you know, I was writing all of these books and stories and all of this stuff during these 10 years while I was kind of waiting for all of that. And in that process, I knew what I was living was far more beautiful, far scarier, and just more gripping in a way. And I wasn't able to write that story, but I sure knew to take notes.
How did parenting your daughter help you to become a different human and a different parent?
Well, I think that's where people get into trouble a little bit when it comes to accepting their child as trans. They're hung up on that idea that somehow this is a reflection of me, and they over-identify, you know, with the child. Luckily, it was really great that we'd already had some kids and they'd fully disabused us of that notion, you know? But I say, like, every child teaches you how to parent that child. So it's always a different journey. And it was already with all of our kids. But I do remember the exact moment when, and I talk about it in the book, when my husband, who was, you know, a Division I athlete and very cisgender, heterosexual guy, came to me and told me what he was worried about. Once he had to tell his friends and his buddies on his soccer teams that this would seem like his weakness made manifest. Then we got to break that down and say, really, did you make our oldest son his masculinity? Did your father make you exactly, you know, masculine and feminine? Did he have his hand on the dial? Is that how this works? You know, or do the kids come out very much who they are? In that way, you know, we got to get rid of that thought pretty quickly. One of the things that it's helped the most with is that these lessons are transferable in raising a daughter who's, you know, a minority who in a group that's often bullied and has trouble getting basic rights of education and now just being allowed to play sports or being able to go to the bathroom without segregation. So it's helped me see the lives of other mothers in particular with much more clarity and much more empathy.
You also write about how it opened your eyes to thinking about gender in different ways. Tell us a little bit more about that.
When you're not trans, you grow up thinking very little about your specific gender. But even as, you know, how we are gendered as we grow up is actually really foundational. And one of my earliest memories was about being misgendered. My parents had gone away. My older sister gave me this terrible pixie haircut. you know, the newspaper man called me Sunny, and I burst into tears. And so that little misgendering, it rattled me as a kid. It was hard. But then to think about trans kids who are just misgendered all day, every day, that is their constant, and how they're looking out at the world and not seeing themselves seen in any way. It's a real erasure when you're not seen for who you are in such a fundamental way.
Your daughter, very early on, was very clear about her own identity. And yet some of the professional advice that you were receiving was to push back against that identity. Can you talk to me a little bit about the nature of that advice and how you decided to move away from that and to be gender affirming?
I like the idea that we open up a middle space for kids. You know, we give kids space to be non-binary or to move through this and think about it in their own way and on their own terms, and that we're really following their lead. So she was the one who said, no, I'm not a boy, you know, who likes girl things. I understood where that researcher was coming from. And I do think that there are ways for us to open up the middle space as a culture for just gender expression in all different ways.
Let's take a quick break here. We're going to have more of my conversation with Carolyn Hayes coming up in just a moment. Stay with us. It's The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
In a girlhood, I tell both difficult and beautiful truths, handing over a record of her early years while tracking the connections I was making.
You're still with The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and we're listening here to Carolyn Hayes, author of the new memoir, A Girlhood, Letter to My Transgender Daughter.
As a witness, record keeper, and archivist, I found universal truths about the richness of gender, motherhood, girlhood, the intricate and stunning architecture of the brain, the long history of trans people, botany and migration, the science of seeing and being seen, God and feminism, and the world that takes shape around her. This is the story of opening a space for her girlhood and holding that space viscerally. It's the story of my body as a mother and this family as a larger body that built itself around her to hold that space collectively. One day, she might choose to write her own story or make art from these pages or upcycle them into armature or a gown or something we can't imagine. She will create her own grand mythology, as we all should. This book is my contribution to that ultimate work.
Carolyn's commitment to her child's health, safety, humanity, and freedom against an onslaught of anti-trans state regulations is a harrowing narrative of parental love, as is her openness to learning from her daughter.
I was certainly liberated by the idea that gender is a social construct, but it really kind of gets in the way sometimes when I'm talking about my daughter, because yes, pink is for girls in our culture, and that's, you know, arbitrary. But what we're talking about here is something very deep. When she told me, and it really was clarified for me, she was talking about her beauty. And she said, when you say I'm beautiful, say she is beautiful. And for me, that was, you know, no one gets to say, except for you yourself, how your beauty is seen, right? That is you. And so for me, that was a real deep, almost the level of her soul, of her divinity, you know, that I saw there, that we're talking about something very different than just kind of the scaffolding of gender.
I want to go to the point that you made about following your daughter's lead and the ways that traditional parenting and parenting advice can sometimes tell us we shouldn't even follow our children's lead when it comes to, for example, their food choices at dinner, right? You'll end up with chicken nuggets and French fries exclusively for their whole lives. How do you know when to trust the lead of your child and when to assert kind of these parental rules?
For this group, and in particular for transgender kids, there was a statistic that I couldn't look away from, and that was, you know, the really high, almost 50%, something like that, suicide attempt rate for trans kids who are not supported. You want happy, healthy, thriving children. And I really think that to see a child as they want to be seen is a lot different than, you know, chicken nuggets. You know, not seeing a child for who they really are is a form of neglect. You're not reflecting back to them, you know, in a deep way. And you're seeing something that's a version you want to see. As a Catholic, I was raised by nuns, and they said, be who you are and be that well. And so my daughter told me who she was. And it was my job as a parent to make sure that she could be that person well.
You talk about the rates of suicide and self-harm among trans young people. We know that the realities of peer and of social and political world also intervene here. During your daughter's lifetime, the political landscape in the U.S., the active legislative efforts to single out trans young people has reached a kind of public fever pitch in recent years. What did that mean for you and for your daughter?
It's really hard to live in America right now in this bifurcated state, because in some places there's such full support and, you know, kids can be out. And then there are, you know, Texas is home to almost 30 million people. And what happened to us, you know, being accused of child abuse, which seemed like just such a strange, like an error, just such a mistake, is now something that governor has signed into law. You know, in Virginia, Gavin Grimm won a lawsuit to make sure that trans kids could, you know, attend their K-12s as they are and have the right to the bathroom and of their gender identity. And then that governor just, you know, took all of that away this week. For us, you know, when we first started this journey, there are about 13 states that were, that had laws that protected my daughter. And then that got up to like 21. We even went below the Mason-Dixon line and it was great. And then this, like the heart of America just contracted, you know, against trans people and trans kids in particular. And a lot of that is because, you know, there are people who want to make this a divisive issue, who want to use it for political purposes. You know, they're making up problems where there are no problems, targeting people with misinformation. You know, we had a bomb threat made against Boston Children's Hospital, death threats against the doctors who work there in the gender clinic. I believe that the person at fault there are really the people who are stoking the flames. Some of them are politicians, and some of them are just people who thrive on misinformation and media, social networks, and hatred.
I love this language of America's heart contracting. So whose heart is contracting and whose is opening? Can you talk a little bit about maybe some of the surprising allies that you have found?
There's a evangelical Texas minister. and then there, you know, the nuns who raised me were fantastic. I'll get really nervous sometimes when I know that somebody is really religious or kind of far right. And I've been surprised by how open they are. Once they know us, they get it. Yeah, Harvey Milk would say we need more out trans people. And I'm that makes me really happy about people like Laverne Cox and Janet Mock and Jen Richards and legislators like Sarah McBride and Danica Rome, who are out and doing really great work.
How do issues of race and socioeconomic status also cross-cut this? I'm thinking about that knock from Child Protective Services and how many poor families and Black families have received that knock on the door for a wide variety of reasons, but how these legislative actions, public policies and opinions about gender identity might also heighten that vulnerability even more.
We were quickly put in touch with, you know, leading experts. And one of them took me through a list of questions just to assess our risk. She asked us our race, and we said white, asked us if we were cisgender, if we were heterosexual, if we had money that we could throw at this. You know, it was just a list of privilege going right straight down. Every time I said, you know, yes, I've got this answer, I reduced our risk. And as I was saying yes, I could see the person who said, you know, no, actually, you know, we're a Black family. No, we're a lesbian couple. And I could just see their risk reducing. And I was haunted by that. It is hard sometimes to talk about, to use the civil rights movement, but there are so many parallels. The right to education, the right to non-segregated bathrooms. A lot of the things that are going on in sports have similarities to the way Black athletes were first treated. It goes a long way back, and also terrorizing families by threatening or by taking away their children. That has a long history in the United States in Native populations, all the way up to what we saw at the border under the Trump administration. You know, that was policy to rip families apart. There's a lot of lessons that can be, you know, transferable.
That was Carolyn Hayes on her new memoir, A Girlhood, Letter to My Transgender Daughter.